Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Exchange. It's good to have you back. We've got a great show today. The usual filler of Masonic history and a very lively discussion that I think you're all going to enjoy. I've been amazed checking some of the checking our records here at the ground level. The entire production team has informed me that the response to our programs has just left the charts. I thought having 1,000 listeners would be, you know, just beyond belief. But 3,500 listeners tuning in, I am just astounded and pleased, as you can imagine, that we're connecting like that. That's the makes all of this work and all this effort so much more worthwhile. I think part of it, too, to be very candid, is that we've created a model that allows access when you need it, when you want it. Now, of course, I'd like to have you here joining me live. There's no question about that. And that said, I'm going to open this up to more interaction. I tried this when we were in the early stages of the program, and it made it complicated, because I can't carry on and think and chew gum at the same time, trying to deal with the lively conversation at the time on a chat and still carry on the program for all of the listeners out there. So we're going to try and do that. I have some speakers in mind. I don't want to talk to them about, I can't give you their names just yet, because we've got to ask permission. I don't want to run afoul of the work of any Grand Lodge. I just want to push the ideas of Masonry General to the forefront and allow the audience out there to make their decisions as they see fit. We are in interesting times, my brethren. So we're going to get back to filling in a thoughtful discussion of the very first charge. And you know, it just, what happens is it just leaks ideas. And I think that's enormously important. I've been, a little bit taken back by some of my research in the past week about Isaac Newton. I thought, you know, the man could walk on water, only to find that he was completely human. Though he is cited as the nexus between Aristotle, the nexus is Newton, the great physicist of the 20s and 30s. And so, you know, when you sum up history in terms of greatness, I'm a little bit utopian, and I challenge us, the order, for falling into that trap repeatedly. I always think that the great men are great men. Great scientists are great people, but great musicians are wonderful, and the poets are sensational people, great conversationalists, and I want to at least intellectually bond with them or connect with them or know that they would be interested and we would have something in common. The truth is that they are just as fallible as anybody else. Interesting work on about Newton. I did not expect the shallowness and pettiness of the man to be part of the historical record, but it was so profound. I keep thinking, what could have happened if he had not been like that? He was really the dictator of the Royal Society for a significant amount of time. And darn it, I can't really pull away from the idea that the Royal Society was a catalyst. A lot of people that were Masons at the time were thinkers and scientists that were members of the Royal Society. And you know, you had to petition. You had to petition for that. You had to be sponsored. And, of course, some great people that may be good scientists, you know, philosophically, celebrity doesn't mean that you're bright in any other way. It just means that you're good at what you're good at. But we often forget. We'll make our celebrities here in Canada politicians, if you can imagine that. Or we'll begin to think that what's coming out of their mouth actually makes sense because they're a celebrity after all, don't you know? We've had criminals that have gained that notoriety, as if we can wash their laundry in public because of their brashness. Anyway, I want you to settle back into your most comfortable chair with your cup or mug or flagon of whatever it is that helps you to relax. A nice cup of Darjeeling, of course. Listen on. To the challenges and to the notions that come out here today. That said, I'm not going to. I wish we had some sponsorship here so the sponsors could take credit for a lot of this. But it's been the work and effort and comments and thoughts and ideas that have been part of our conversations over the years. And I am grateful to each and every one of you. This Lake Masonry doesn't happen without you. Whether you're very feeble at it, whether you're disinterested most of the time, or whether you're intellectually keen and searching for answers, each piece of the puzzle is performed by a human being. And the thought. Now, that said, we're going to talk about that minority group, that's this audience. Out of all of the millions of Masons out there, this is the thread that inspires me. I'm not too concerned about the other priorities within Masonry. Always a small group have kept the thread of Masonry, the essence of Masonry alive, and that can't be extinguished because it's an intellectual pursuit, an intellectual spiritual event, an experience, always the experience. Nothing, as they say here today, tempers a man more than experience. I'm wondering why there is so much concern to rehabilitate men who simply lack ability. That discussion isn't new within Masonry, and there has to be. And where has it taken us, really? This has been going on for a long time. What's wrong with the craft? Why aren't more people showing up? Why are people showing up and not paying attention? You know, why are we straying off topic? Why aren't we doing our work? Why aren't we becoming scholars of the craft? So the lamentation plagues the craft and, I say, corrosively undermines the philosophy of Masonry. We initiate a fellow without knowing him, truly. Proof of his nature and intellect surfaces only after we have welcomed him into Lodge, on a hope that he won't disappoint. Sometimes it takes months, sometimes years, but always the truth comes out. And we're good with that. To only initiate worthy men would require a change of thinking that is beyond the order. We would be openly selective. Today, we act with a sense of desperation. Recruitment based on a pulse. Got a pulse? We'll make you a Mason. One senior of a degree mill lodge explained this was a steady source of revenue. It kept annual fees low. I hope one day I learn to overcome the sense of repulsion I felt toward him. I'm imperfect too and not there yet. We need to be so much more candid, honest, and accepting than we have been because it is toxic to Masonry to determine some members are inadequate. Not at all. They are what they are. They get what they get. They give what they feel is in their best interest, and there is no more. Move on. Your obligation pointed to a path of enlightenment. That is what you took from initiation. This is your intelligence, your personality, your talents and ambitions. But how does a good Mason justify this sense of hubris? For a time, the Romans made it a criminal offense to laud your position over another. And to suggest it should and can be corrected? Isn't that a bit reckless? Nothing distinguishes superficial Masons more than those who reach a mature age with the manners and values of a child. This is a microcosm of real life. Beneath surface or clueless that it even exists, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. We move on, but it is the truth. Now, how can you not want to be part of that process? The toxicity, the corrosiveness, is thinking about other members of the craft as wrong. And the discussion about it is simply a distraction. It's a red herring. It's a red herring. And if you get right down to it, tackle it and prove to me that it's that discussion is important to Masonry. Prove that to me. Show me the math. I haven't seen it. All I've seen is that it seems to color our sense of enthusiasm and our sense of purpose. So in this laboratory, I have 100 very keen students sitting there around me, and I am, I hope, worthy of being one of them. And there are some that are coming in that are a bit dozy. They're there because their dad feels that they need this education, and dad has deep pockets and pays for it, but they sit there a little bit dozy, but feeling privileged in some way. Others are sensing that they have a privilege because they've arrived in this group. Of course, it's a bit stunted, isn't it? The ability of the people that got there is of little concern, isn't it? What's being taught? So the message that nobody says to us is pay attention. Pay attention. Spirituality within Freemasonry is the paradox. Why paradox? Because spirituality went beyond what was going on at the time the constitutions and Masonry was being formed. There were a universe of ideas that coalesced into these ideas as the foundation of a fraternal order. The influences at the time really were forged in courts, in the debates, since where reason was finally, even in the late 16th century, where reason, where fact was finally, and still, overcoming the battles of superstition, overcoming the influence of the major powers of history, state, and religion. Remember that for a long time, for about 1400 years, it's a bit unfair to, in some ways, but it's legitimate in others, to say that going to a person that is translating Scripture to find the answers for what is happening in the universe, for perception, is so wrong. Was so wrong. Those battles have been fought, but have they? 21st century, we live in a world where people in a very affluent culture still believe that mankind walked around at the time of the dinosaurs. Does that truly changed the nature of the truths of science? Not a bit. And are they worth, is that group of people worth much attention? Somewhat. Because if that's the popular myth, if that's becoming more and more popular, we need to do something to challenge that with a bit of reason, don't we? Reasonable men, reasonable ideas, teaching the facts. Because change of heart and a change of mind is possible. And if we don't come to Freemasonry with that in mind, why are we here? To be static? To be remote? In a sense, we're here to embrace change, that fearful word, to change, based on our insight about ourselves. And when we do that, the picture ain't pretty. We expose ourselves to ourselves. We expose our weaknesses to ourselves with the knowledge that we're not going to dwell on it, as nobody should, no right-minded fellow should. But we're going to acknowledge it, put it on the list of things we need to work on to change. Not to put on the list and say, there, I'm a wonderful boy, look what I've done. But to actually demonstrate the change through our behavior. It's not enough to talk the talk. We actually need to demonstrate, not to anybody else, but to ourselves, by our behavior, what we're capable of doing. But always associate yourselves with like-minded men, like you, that are good for you, that are lively in conversation and inspire you as you do them. The Masonic paradox. Spirituality takes us beyond the experience of the profane. To be able to find answers to what organized religion has not fulfilled. Now, we may, in fact, come back to organized religions. It's entirely possible. This isn't a hierarchy. This is delving into truths. So you become a student of whatever faith you are. A student. Not to become overbearing with the power of your faith, because then it's dishonest to impose your faith, our faith, my faith, on any other human being. Dishonest, deceitful, maddening. As we see going on, it's a never-ending discussion for thoughtful people. Remember, at the end of the day, it isn't about winning and losing. It's about the truth. The truth always comes to the surface. It sets us free. So, come back with me. Think about that a bit. Think about that. And think about the creation and reverence of the sacred space inside of a lodge. I know you've heard mention of what we've done to erode that sacredness. We've taken the music away, which is part of the reason that this show always has a portion for music. Why have we done that? Why? Why have we taken something beautiful that seems to be part of every significant ceremony in cultures away from Masonry? Well, I'm evaluating the process and saying that was something that we need to correct. That music is the harmony of Masonry. It sets us into a contemplative state of mind. Something sacred is happening. And we are attentive, but at a different level of profoundness. And we deserve that. If anything has been missing from Masonry, it's that experience. Not to blame. This isn't about blame and shame and that process. This is about paying attention, observation. The more lodges wrap themselves around these types of notions and remember that this is part of our collective heritage, the more prepared they'll be to reintroduce music. This is going to be like teaching at a whole different level. Are we going to like it? Well, come on. Is it going to be awkward? Well, of course. Will there be grumpy old men who can't handle the change? Only about a third of the lodge will be able to see the merit. Another third will sit on their hands, take it as it comes. A third will resist, you know, they'll resist change, not because it's music in a lodge, but that's just the nature of their, it's an impermanent. And then about 10%, well, they're just what we think of lovingly as assholes. They are what they are. They're necessary in lodge. They play and perform an important part, an important lesson in our development and reasoning. Believe it as it's been handed down to us. How about we move on with a little bit of the things that rock a Mason's soul? A little bit of a chit-chat about what in the world is going on. What were they thinking of when they put that together? Don't you find masonry is like a, I didn't know that, and I wish I'd known that earlier. And I wish I'd had this kind of conversation earlier. And I wish there was more of this kind of conversation. But I think of it like a box of a Belgian chocolate. You know, you take out a glass of 20-year-old or a nice glass of whiskey in your favorite tumbler. You sit back, you open up a box of Belgian chocolate, and you take a sip and you take a nibble. And watch what happens. See what happens. That's not something you want to do every moment of every day. It's those moments where you just are experiencing something sublime. You can do the same thing with a cup of good tea or a nice measure of espresso, sure. Or a dipper full of spring water when you're out camping in some of the amazing parts of this country, that moment when you just feel connected and inspired, and you're thinking, you know, when the Creator put it together, really isn't bad. Anyway, let's get on with this. You know what I mean? So, get out your little box of chocolate and pick a few, and then a sip of a nice something. And that will join me with you, of course. It's been a long time. Well, we need to talk about the stupid atheist. You know, it's kind of important that we talk about what this stuff means. Oh, well, we already understand. Well, we already don't. Remember, you and I are 20th century boys, and the language that we're talking about is 18th century. And the meaning changes. Why do you think there's so much of a dust-up over any kind of translation of the written word? Why do you think? Because there's an effort that we can stop, that the initial meaning and intent needs to be passed on. And fair play, have at it. But not everybody. Some people are really influenced by the meaning of the words in the vernacular today. What is happening today? What do these words mean? Anyway, it took me a while. I remember when I started to realize that when you see these words carved out in stone and the U is done as a V, I never could quite get that. And then it seemed to told me that it's very practical. It's hard to make those little bellies, isn't it? Easier. Anyway. I have this craving to talk about stupid atheists. Stupid atheist this. Stupid atheist libertines. We went over that, didn't we? And we went over a little bit of an analysis of the Hebrew word for fool. We did that. Yeah, of course. So and just a little, let's kickstart this just a little bit, okay? Here's a little bit of an analysis of the Hebrew word for fool. Okay? Is this that we are students of Hebrew? Yeah. We're students of a lot of things. We're students of science that was developed in from the Arab culture, the Chinese culture, the European culture. You and I are those have that banquet that serves dishes from around the intellectual world. Not what it is today, but what it was, the ideas that came forward and the things that we rely on, the science, the ideas. Well, there we have our stupid atheists. They are practical atheists. So this, we're talking 1717. When we're going back to this state of trying to understand. So this conversation is not new. We're part of a conversation that went on a great long time. The Bible, including the New Testament, Jews would probably be classified with the deists. Atheism was thought to be so logically inconsistent that only madmen or perverts could be convinced of it. That was then. This is now. Many claimed there was no such thing as a genuine atheist and adapted their terminology accordingly. The borderline between atheists and deists and between their different sorts was ill-defined. Ill-defined for a reason. It's like when I talk to somebody, I go into a church. Do I expect that the people in there understand the difference between Lutheran and Presbyterian and the Baptist or Anabaptist movement? Yeah, I do. Do I hear that? No. No. Rarely. So give me a set of knickerbockers and a set of golf clubs and I'm a golfer. Oh, and by the way, do I have to learn how to swing a club? So deist, you need to know what that means, you know? Deist. We need to be able to, I'm going to give you a definition of that, at least, yeah? Okay. It's a Dutch word, and it combines a rejection, deism. This is what we're looking at. Don't look at deist. Deism is derived from the Latin word deus, which means God, and it combines a rejection of religious knowledge as a source of authority with the conclusion that reason and observation of the natural world are sufficient to determine the existence of a singular creator of the universe. Is that you? So, you see the Mason in this word? Combines a rejection of religious knowledge as a source of authority with the conclusion that reason and observation of the natural world are sufficient to determine the existence of a single creator of the universe. Deism gained prominence among intellectuals during the Age of Enlightenment, especially in Britain, France, and Germany. The Age of Enlightenment is an era from the 1650s to the 1780s. In which cultural and intellectual forces in Western Europe emphasized reason, analysis, and individualism rather than traditional lines of authority. Liberty, equality, fraternity, do you see it here? It was promoted by philosophies and local thinkers in urban coffee houses. We've talked about that in the program. We've talked about the penny universities, particularly in Paris and London, and the salons and Masonic lodges. It challenged the authority of institutions that were deeply rooted in society, such as one of the churches that I went, Catholic Church. There was much talk of ways to reform society with tolerance, science, and skepticism, you know, prove it a bit. So again, come back to the same group. I can't rewrite history. Francis Bacon, René Descartes, John Locke. I'll only give you a suggestion that you read one of them, okay? But start with Francis Bacon. If you want to see the ideas that are part of the thinking that was written down as the ethos of Masonry, start with the ideas, not with the outcome. Masonry is an outcome, a hybrid, a vehicle, and it's important. So coinciding with the Age of Enlightenment that we're talking about here was the Scientific Revolution. And that was spearheaded historically by Sir Isaac Newton. Right? So you see how it begins to fit together, the overlap. So now you have a sense of Age of Enlightenment, you have a sense of deism. Yeah, of course. So nothing tempers a man more than experience. So we're going to go and move toward a little erringness. Unlike atheists and deists, base their opinions not on the principles of reason alone, but also on a testimony and evidence of matter of fact. Okay? A matter of fact. The Bible, including the New Testament, Jews would probably be classified with the deists. Would we? Now think. Including the New Testament. We're putting in deism as a natural religion. Deists believe in the existence of God on purely rational grounds, without any reliance on revealed religion or religious authority or holy text. Because of this, deism is quite different from religions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's a theological position concerning the relationship between the Creator and the natural world. Atheism was thought to be so logically inconsistent that only madmen or perverts could be convinced of it. Many claimed there was no such thing as a genuine atheist and adapted their terminology accordingly. The borderline between an atheist and deist, and between their different sorts, was ill-defined and changed with fashion and personal conviction. Thus, opposers of a providence are atheists. Thus, opposer of a providence are atheists for de Saulnier. So if you're a deist, you're an atheist in de Saulnier's mind. Now remember, he was a Presbyterian minister, a Huguenot, and they were deists for Clark. Some allowed for decent atheists and deists, but most were convinced that man went effectively immoral as soon as there was no punishment to be feared. Is that what you believe? That unless we have the use of the whip, that we are immoral? To hell with you. To hell with that. Therefore, immorality was often seen to be intrinsically linked to atheism or deists. The desire to live an immoral life is often the ultimate explanation for rejecting what theologians and preachers considered to be reason itself. Oh, well, I disagree with this because they have a desire to be immoral. Not at all. Who's the fool now? The age was very much under the influence of Newton's amazing achievements in science. Many copied the style of his Principia Mathematica and claimed to be proving propositions, sometimes throwing in genuine scientific arguments involving gravitation or mathematics. Any theological position was declared to be proved by reason, and any opposing view was proved to be folly or unreasonableness. Terms like stupid, sottish, absurd, foolish, mad, ignorant, and senseless, abounded. Stupid atheists, a sort of deists. Masons obliged to obey the moral law cannot be atheists. On the other hand, they, or at least those who don't yet understand the art rightly, the art being the craft, can be stupid atheists. So, what are you saying here to us? Sir, are you saying that if you're a bit clueless, you could be, without knowing it, considered a stupid atheist? But they are not atheists. Strange as it may sound, this is exactly the case. Doesn't Masonic Exchange always get the gears grinding? People who did not philosophically deny God's existence, but lived as if he did not exist, were called practical atheists. The adjective meaning by behavior, not by opinion. The notion and the terminology occur already in 1664 in a sermon by John Tillotson, who later became the Archbishop of Canterbury. And by 1708, both had made it into church catechisms. The terminology was most misleading because everyone agreed and said so, that practical atheists were no speculative Mason atheists at all. Wow, there's a little Freudian slip. I can't even say speculative without saying Mason after. Let me read that again. I apologize. The terminology was most misleading because everyone agreed and said so, that practical atheists, those that lived as if he did not exist, were no speculative atheists at all. Some classified them nonetheless with the atheists, others with the deists. Clark's deists, considered together for that purpose, are practical atheists because it is observable that their practice and behavior is exactly agreeable to that of the most openly professed atheists. This behavior includes those aspects which Anderson's contemporaries identified most with libertinism, namely the dreaded libertine wit. They endeavor to ridicule and banter all humane as well as divine accomplishments, says Anderson, ridiculing whatever bears any resemblance to it, God's wisdom in men, turning everything alike and without exception into ridicule and banter. These things, true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, they make the subject of their constant drollery and abuse, ridicule and raillery. Such men as these are not to be argued with till they can be persuaded to use arguments instead of drollery. I just think of them kindly as assholes, but do you know drollery? The smallest possible unit of an illegal substance, it is not possible. Drollery. Do you know it? Drollery problem. I'm going to just tell you, give you a definition so you can see it in your own mind. No use arguing with such men. Those that ridicule and banter. Now think of them intellectually, not in terms of the being a stuffed shirt. No, that's just hurtful to you. It brings that tension forward, and you don't need that. You're a Mason, and you're going to rise above the pedestrian argument and use your mind and your ability to reason to find the truths. So recognize these are people that haven't found the truths. It doesn't stop them acting as if they have. The marginal note by Anderson says, profane and debauched deists are not capable of being argued with. The adjectives refer to the very profane and very lewd images and debauched and vitreous inclinations of both sorts of atheists. Here, profane seems to have the meaning characterized by disregard or contempt of sacred things. Huh. So, how often have I used the word profane to mean public? As if I'm a bit snooty. As if anybody that's not of the craft is profane, meaning they have a disregard or contempt of sacred things. I apologize. I had no idea. I'm using the language improperly. I have no way of knowing whether somebody walking past a not Mason, it's like saying every woman around who, because you can't be a Mason, is for other reasons, is profane, that they have disregard for sacred things. Well, that's just not true. Among those regretting the misleading noun in Practical Atheists was Thomas Wise. In 1706, he published they love long titles. Get this, A Confutation of the Reason and Philosophy of Atheism, being in a great measure either an abridgment or an improvement of what Dr. Cudworth offered to what purpose in his True Intellectual System of the Universe. So we have to read Dr. Cudworth's Purpose of the Universe. It was an attempt to improve the long and muddled classic, The True Intellectual System of the Universe, wherein all the reason and philosophy of atheism is confuted and its impossibility demonstrated. That was 1678. And the author of that was Ralph Cudworth. He died just 10 years later. He was a professor of Hebrew philosopher and leader of the remarkable group known as the Cambridge Platonists. Now remember, we talked about the Platonists and the Nominalists, didn't we? We did just last week. And nominalism. I'm just bringing it up in front of me because I have a problem getting my tongue around that. Remember, this gets into Platonism and metaphysics, and does something. The Platonists believe that the notion of Platonism, not that you're a follower of the philosophy of Plato, but it's that something metaphysical does exist. And the nominalist thinking is that if it doesn't exist in time and space, it doesn't exist. So remember, that's the reference that we have here. Lovely, these long titles, aren't they? Just phenomenal. So Wise states, not after all that I suppose there are or ever have been any absolute speculative atheists, or such as fully answer that character, being thoroughly grounded and convinced in their minds that there is no God. I suppose there are or ever have been absolute speculative atheists. And he continues, therefore, I would wish that the term atheist, as men are apt to understand it in this sense, were not so generally used. After some examples of historical figures falsely called atheists, we find those and some others who have heretofore come under the character, yet were not atheists in the sense before mentioned, but either opposers or deriders of the national superstition, or else they have been so called, at least in the latter of the following senses, in that I own that two sorts of men, making, alas, too great a part of the world, might in all ages come under that name. First, such as Dr. Cudworth distinguishes by the appellation of stupid atheists, inasmuch they cannot reason on the matter, but being already great sinners and willing to continue such, they cannot away with the thoughts of that God, for whom they can look nothing but vengeance and the revelation of righteous judgment. And therefore, what do they endeavor in this case but to divert their reason and stupefy their conscience by hurry and intemperance? Till at length, custom getting the better and benumbing their intellectual powers, they have not God in all their thoughts, and so live on as if indeed there were no God, and apparently are without him in this world. And these are properly practical atheists, or such as, in plainer English, what may be termed ungodly men. Secondly, there is another sort of atheists who, having, like the former, a bent to impiety, and so the same prejudice against a God, take upon them to philosophize about the point, and by principles of reason to dispute his existence, or at least to advance such notions of him as imply that he is not infinitely perfect, and so in effect that he is not at all. Being not able to convince themselves fully that there is no God, yet venturing to live as if there were none, and these are the great champions and upholders of the former, that is, of the stupid atheists or ignorant, ungodly men. There we have our stupid atheists. Twice they are practical atheists. In 1717, Wise returned to the subject. Now remember, Anderson, there wasn't a constitution where there was organization, there was administration. There was the beginnings of the Masonic bureaucracy. Yeah. He says, but as for practical atheists, or such as in plainer English we might have termed ungodly men, in that they live without God in the world and have him not in all their thoughts, and who, though not pretending on rational grounds to deny the existence of God, yet do presume to live their lives as if there was none. Of such I say that there have been great numbers in all times and places, and these are the persons who, in King David's language, do justly come under the character of fools. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And after a linguistic analysis of the Hebrew word for fool, he concludes that David, in speaking here of a fool, did not mean what we commonly term a natural or one born a fool, but one who willfully and through his own fault has made himself such. So we're not naturally born a fool, which supposes in him the utmost folly, aggravated with downright madness, thwarting the purpose that they were designed for, and acting most irrationally against the natural obligations, do appear to have lost their understandings, and as under the circumstance are literally egregious fools, morally dead, as having lost the life of men, that is, the exercise of reason, wisdom, and grace. When being so stupid, so besotted, as to say in their hearts, there is no God, in which words it is not supposed that they are going so far as to pronounce or aver this openly, nay, nor that they are convinced of it in their minds, but only that in their wills and affections, which are here denoted by the heart, they are pleased with an inward fantasy that there is no God, or with a desire that there were none. If their principles may be judged of from their practices, they do deserve no better title than that of atheists or deniers of God in their works, and therefore likewise that of fools. It's like Wise is making a compelling argument that somebody may say it, but they may not believe it in their heart, and therefore they aren't atheists. They do believe. Isn't that interesting? He's trying to stay connected, connect the denier with a sense of the Creator. Wise replaces stupid by his own ignorant or David's fool. In his linguistic analysis, he claims that St. Paul's Greek word for foolish in Romans 10:19 meant imprudent without understanding, refers to the same. Generally, stupid meant having one's faculties deadened or dulled, apathetic or indifferent. Like in dull, stupid atheists cursed with want of sense, which thy beloved atoms can't dispense, they are the perfect image of thy mind, both senseless, rambling, incoherent, and blind. It has been long debated whether Anderson's stupid atheist is an atheist, hence stupid, or an atheist of the stupid sort. Wise's stupid atheist is neither. But someone living like an atheist while not being one, hence stupid, ignorant, foolish, impotent. Stupid atheists are, philosophically speaking, no atheists at all. They believe in God and say so publicly. In consideration or neglect to think about God, his attributes, and this being undoubtedly a general source of religion and impiety, nay, of all the practical atheism and ungodly living, which are now so rife and common in the world, where it is too often seen that multitudes of persons, however they profess, and this truly too, that they know God, yet do in works deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate. That's from Titus 1:16. And what conceivable occasion can there be for their contradicting their profession by their practice? By what they do not distinctly attend to the light that is before them, and which, though in it might suffice to give them a right and clear knowledge of God and their duties, yet not maintaining in their minds a present actual sense of, therefore they make no use or benefit of it, but apparently live without God in the world, and in effect, practical atheists. That is, deniers of God in their works. However, in words, they profess that they know him. So, talking without the behavior reveals the truth. We have not been able to locate stupid atheists in Cudworth's true intellectual system of the universe, where Wise claims to have found it. Perhaps Wise abridged and improved things to the point of making them unrecognizable. Irreligious libertines, another source of deists. The word libertine had, even to a greater degree than atheist, several meanings, being simultaneously around. Now remember the period we're talking about. Enough. This is the meal that's too rich for us to take in all at once. This isn't a Christmas celebration and where we're going to indulge ourselves. This is where we're going to sort out, we're going to pull back and sort out our thoughts and begin to reflect on what it is we're saying when we're using these words. What we put onto the lips is very, very hard to retrieve. So, what have we heard here? That somebody that sounds pious and privileged and committed, we also know by virtue of their behavior. So, those people that are indifferent to their friends, to their brethren, those that don't make an effort to fit in but try to dominate. You tell me, is this the nature of Masonry? Wise and Cudmore are telling us something that we need to pay attention. So enough. We need to move on a little bit, eh? Something inspiring to fit and wrap this all together and bring it home for us. Here's something from the heart. You have enemies. You have enemies? Good. That means you've stood up for something sometime in your life. I'll tell you who said that in a moment. Attitude is a little thing that means big difference. If you're going through hell, keep going. We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. Do you know who it is? Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. To improve is to change. To be perfect is to change often. Change. All the great things are simple, and many can be expressed in a single word. Ha. Want to hear the word? Freedom. Justice. Honor. Duty. Mercy. Hope. It is always wise to look ahead, but difficult to look further than you can see. My most brilliant achievement was my ability to be able to persuade my wife to marry me. I am prepared to meet my maker. Whether my maker is prepared for the great ordeal of meeting me is another matter. Criticism may not be agreeable, but it is necessary. It fulfills the same function as pain in the human body. It calls attention to an unhealthy state of things. This will make the speaker more evident. Never, never, never give up. Continuous effort, not strength or intelligence, is the key to unlocking our potential. I may be drunk, miss, but in the morning I will be sober and you will still be ugly. Of course, Winston Churchill. The best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. Honestly, a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. So to the optimists that tune in to the Masonic Exchange, we're going to give you a little bit of folk music. Is that okay? I'll end it with a Canadian version, but we're going to start with a little bit from France and then from Ireland and then from big country. Here you go. Thank you very much for tuning in to Masonic Exchange. It's been great having you here. Thank you for making this a success. I hope you've been... The ideas have proved worth chewing on, and perhaps you'll savor them a little bit later. Tell your friends, only your good friends, about Masonic Exchange. And I hope, of course, that the great architect of the universe watches over you. Commit those random acts of Masonic kindness. And remember, spring's only about, 34 days away? Ha ha! This is from the classical Renaissance music, Monteverdi. Thank you. Bad Boys. Not bad. That's from music from 1632. Always some relevance. Here's a little more relevant music. This is more traditional Irish. This is from Ennis, Ireland. That's great.
Turn your stallion's head, till a friend named Fire. And the rider of the moon goes by, and the bright star falls behind. And clear was the failing moon when the shadow passed him by. Below the hill were the brightest stars, and he heard the owl cry, saying, why do you ride this way? Wherefore came you here? I see the witch of the west, their land, who dwells for the winding mere. It's nearly by the owl's water, and the misty breaker wave, till through the cleft of the crystal path, the winding water. Down the brindle town, rest ye me, good grey hawk, and be my steed, the grey sight, who from us dismount and walk. But come when you hear my horn, and answer with the call, for I fear the sun will rise this morn, you will serve me best of all. It's down to the water's brim, he's born the rowing shield. And the golden rod he has cast in to see what the lake might yield. And when rose she from the lake, and passed the when she one has the form of a maiden fair with a jet black fair body. And sounds on the truly blue till his name is by the tiny tide. Overhead the grey hawk down the rowing shield, for I see by the briny blood that flows, you've been wounded in the field. She stood in a gown of a velvet blue, bound round with a silver chain, and she kissed his veil at once and twice, and three times round again. And she found his womb with a golden rod, oh, past her arms he lay, and he had never made
Absolutely. Spirit of Stan Rogers just continues to resonate through here. I was reminded that the brethren and guests that we're coming up to a spectacular religious event. That would be 36 days and 14 hours and 49 minutes from now when it's St. Patrick's Day. So we're going to kill off Stan here. And we're going to pick up a little bit of the Rum Jacks out of Ireland and let the party begin here. And here's to you. Cheers.
Here they come, came up to go with the punch and trip the willows, wipe me up the ranks and mellow and lift me, never run so shallow, we got it an Irish pub.
And that's what the Australians call Irish pop music. They'll learn. They're young. Cheers. I'll see you again. Thanks for joining us here on Masonic Exchange. And drink up.